Welcome to the third episode of the QICAG podcast. I'm your host, April Dinwiddie, communications consultant for the QICAG. With the six key messages as a guide, this podcast will highlight the practical tools, materials, and content created by the QICAG and offer a deeper understanding of how it all can be useful for members of the child welfare community, as well as allied professionals and parents. Today, we welcome Leslie Cohen, QICAG Project Director, to have a conversation about the importance of responding to families' unique service needs. Welcome to the podcast, Leslie.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So first, I wanted to do a bit of a series recap and remind listeners of the first two podcasts we shared several months back. The first episode with Dr. Mark Testa focused on the first key message, supporting families that provide permanence. Mark had so much to say about the changing dynamic of the child welfare system and how critical it is that we shift our thinking in terms of what families need. In the second episode, Melinda Liss was with us for a conversation about empowering families to seek support, the second QICAG message. She helped to frame the need of the child welfare system to encourage families to seek services and support and to be lifelong learners. That brings us to today's conversation. And my first question for you, Leslie, is why responding expediently to families' unique needs is so vital?
So I would say that for this discussion today, it probably makes the most sense to think about the message in two parts. First, responding expediently, and then addressing the unique service needs of families. So I'll start with responding expediently. This simply means that supports for families in need have to be available and accessible at the point in time that the need actually arises. When we think about the second part, addressing the unique needs of families, we are recognizing that not all families are the same. And because of that, it's important to have a myriad of services in which families can participate.
Thanks for breaking all that down, Leslie. With this in mind, how did the QICAG approach the work?
The QIC starts with this very basic idea that no two families are exactly alike. And so while we know from research and anecdotally that, some needs are more common, we really try to keep in mind that the one size fits all mentality just doesn't work when it comes to supporting families. So quite simply, we can't as a system create one type of program and think that it's going to fit all adoptive or guardianships families' needs. I would say that this message in particular reinforces that we need to develop and offer an array of services and supports to meet the needs of families. And what I like about it is it also recognizes that the needs of families change over time. That's why the QIC permanency continuum framework that Melinda spoke about in episode 2 was just so important and foundational to our work. It's the framework that actually gives us concrete language to address the many stages of engagement with families, as well as the level of intensity of service provided at those different stages. So as families move along the continuum, the risk for discontinuity can increase, and therefore, so should the intensity of service.
Got it. Thanks, Leslie. So what are some of the fundamental challenges in collective thinking here?
Well, because we're focused on getting families to permanence, which was and continues to be really important, child welfare historically has not been as focused on post-permanency support. But with all the information that we have today on the long-term impact of trauma and of separation and loss, I would say the system as a whole has a much better understanding of the needs of children and families, especially when it comes to acknowledging that children and families might need supports to address needs that persist or emerge after permanence has been achieved. Clearly, with this information and understanding comes a new sense of responsibility to support these families over time. In fact, in episode 1, Mark Testa actually discusses the shift in child welfare from children in public custody to the 21st century, where we are focused on the well-being of children in safe and stable family relationships.
That is really important. I'm glad you mentioned all of that thinking. So now with all of this and the QICAG permanency framework as a guide, can you share some of your thoughts on what you think post-permanency services should be?
Sure. Regardless of when families request services, systems need to be able to respond quickly and offer an array of services and supports to meet needs. I would say that post-permanency services and supports need to have a few key elements. They have to be, one, available when needed, right? I mean, without waiting times to obtain the service. They must be responsive to the particular needs of each family versus the idea of one size fits all, which we've already talked a little bit about. It's important that they be evidence-informed or at least rooted in promising practices. Many folks know child welfare is moving in that direction. And lastly, services should be delivered by staff who are adoption or adoption and guardianship competent. And that means they have the training and expertise to adequately meet the needs, the unique needs of adoptive and guardianship families.
Right. I cannot agree more with all that you say here. And I also realize that what you just laid out is no small task to accomplish. Isn't that right?
Right. Exactly. These are big tasks. I totally respect and understand that these kinds of shifts just do not happen overnight. Systems can start this challenging work, however, by assessing both their macro level systems, things like policy or operations or training, as well as assessing their services. This assessment can actually be done by using the continuum assessment, a tool that was created by the QICAG. And this tool helps figure out like what services and supports exist and how accessible are they, or where the gaps in services are along your continuum and how those gaps correlate to the known needs of families. Or maybe how existing services and resources can be leveraged to support families. In addition, for example, where new services and resources are needed. And it can also help figure out how child welfare policies and practices impact how families are supported. I also want to mention here, I want to point out that the child welfare professionals do not need to do this on their own. We need to really engage other systems and professionals from other fields. Ultimately, families benefit, right, when they can get what they need from the many professionals that they're engaged with on a regular basis. So that includes like teachers and doctors, you know, and other folks that they may come into contact with.
Right. There's this this team approach, right, to the support of families. And it makes sense that you acknowledge that. And I know some of the folks that are listening can go to the QICAG website and learn more about the interventions overall. But there's another piece of content that I want to point out, which is the Ask About series, which helps to educate those professionals outside of child welfare that serve families. And, you know, it just makes sense to have those types of resources, and they can all be accessed on the QICAG website. And before we close, I'd love for you to share a couple of practical examples of the QICAG at work.
Absolutely. When Vermont used the continuum assessment tool, they were really struck by the fact that their system just didn't prioritize universal outreach to families after permanence was achieved. In essence, they were really missing that light touch and engagement of families, kind of asking them like, how's it going? Or how are you? How's your child? How's your family? How can we help you? What do you need? Or hey, even we have some services that could meet your needs if you have them. So to address this, the Vermont team included several agencies. It was the Vermont Department of Children and Family Services, Lund, as well as the University of Vermont. They embarked together on a project to determine if universal outreach, which they did in the form of a survey to all adoptive and guardianship families, would help them to do two things. One, identify families who were doing well, and two, identify those families that were experiencing challenges. Ultimately, they hoped that the survey would help them determine the needs, the risks, the strengths of families post-permanence, so that they could provide timely, relevant services and supports.
Right. And, you know, sometimes, Leslie, what can be so simple can be so transformational. And, you know, we have so little time here to talk, but I encourage folks to visit the QICAG.org to learn more about the work in Vermont and all the sites, and to watch the brief yet very powerful videos that have been created that really bring the work to life. So now I think you have one more example to share with us. Is that right?
Yeah, I do. I'd really love to talk about the team of child welfare professionals from the Tennessee Department of Children's Services and one of their private providers, Harmony Family Center. To add some context, the state contracts with Harmony to provide post-adoption services. So Harmony family counselors are trained to use a significant number of therapeutic modalities with the children and families that they serve, but they found that they weren't always sure which one would best meet the needs of the children and families. So in implementing the neurosequential model of therapeutics, also known as NMT, the team now has an assessment tool, the NMT metric, that can help match the unique needs and strengths of children with a specific therapeutic modality, intervention, or activity that will best meet the child's needs. This model provides a way to organize a child's developmental history and current functioning to inform the whole clinical decision-making and treatment planning process. The metric helps the clinical team better understand the nature and timing of adversity and resilience-related factors during the child's development and the impact of those factors on brain development. So ultimately, this approach helps the parent, the teacher, and clinician really better understand the child's current functional strengths and needs. And simply put, NMT assesses the child's brain and maps strengths and weaknesses so that appropriate services can be offered to the child in order to meet their developmental needs.
Well, this is like an amazing program and an intervention. And it sounds like it does all the things that we want to support a child's healthy development. And then it does include those folks that are around, those other professionals that are around that child as well. And obviously the parents and caregivers. So important. I thank you for sharing that. And it is my understanding that Tennessee is working to enlist the help of professionals beyond child welfare to support families. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. Successful implementation of the service recommendations from NMT really necessitates the engagement of a network of people, some of whom we hope are trauma-informed therapeutic professionals. It's important to note that trauma-informed professionals can be difficult to find. So with this in mind, the team in Tennessee acted to create these networks, to create trauma-responsive communities. And they did this by launching forums on the topic of childhood trauma. The forums include presentations on adverse childhood experiences, which some of you may also sort of know or be more familiar with as ACEs, and viewing trauma and trauma interventions through the lens of the neurosequential model. They facilitated discussions with folks that were, I would call them maybe child-serving stakeholders, such as judicial and civics leaders, mayors, law enforcement, healthcare workers, child welfare service providers, mental health professionals. They included educators, faith-based organizations, and community service providers. I mean, they really cast a wide net so they could engage as many people as possible that would touch the lives of the children that they were serving.
Right. This is tremendous, Leslie. And I really just love the integration into all of the other professional realms. This is how we best support children and families, no doubt. So I want to ask you just any final thoughts before we close.
Yeah, I do have a final thought. I really think it's important to recognize that every change doesn't need to be a significant systems level shift or a big evidence-based intervention like what we talked about today. There have been some small changes that our QICAG partner sites have made that have had a really big impact and are worth mentioning. Like one site actually repaired an automated phone line that families used to call in to get help that just wasn't directing families in a way that was working. Another site created a dedicated website. We also found that sending a letter to families with the name and number of a person who they can contact directly for information should they need anything made a difference. So again, everything that impacts your system doesn't have to be a major implementation. Other small things that build capacity and solve problems also matter and can really make a difference to families.
I could not agree more, Leslie. And on that note, we're going to close this episode. But I can't thank you enough for all the work on the QICAG and for this very inspiring and informational conversation today.
Happy to do it.
Today, it's urgent for child welfare and related systems to respond expediently to the unique needs among adoptive and guardianship families and offer an array of evidence-based services and supports. This is big work, and it requires collective commitment to setting a strong foundation and then taking action to offer services to families in need throughout their lifelong journey of adoption and guardianship. The QICAG is funded through the Department of Health and Human Services, Administration for Children and Families, Children's Bureau, grant number 90CO1122-0100. The contents of this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views and the policies of the funders, nor does mention of trade names, commercial products, or organizations imply endorsement by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. This information is in the public domain.